It is 7:07 in the Twin Cities, pretty relatively mild, 55 degrees. My next guest is a name you probably will recognize, Marty Seifert, for many years, I think 13 years. He was in the Minnesota House of Representatives. He actually was the minority leader and ran for governor. And actually, I find it difficult to believe that he hasn't been in the legislature since 2010, but I think that that's right. And he has written a new book that is based on a true crime story that happened in an area right near where he grew up in southwestern Minnesota. And Marty Seifert is joining us right now. Marty, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Esme.
Is it really? Have you been out of the legislature since 2010?
I know. It seems like yesterday, but I mean, I still appear on radio and political events and things. And so the new adventure with authoring the book, obviously, but I still do some, I do some government relations for the rural cities and some disabled folks. And so I still am part-time involved with government relations with the legislature. So, you know, I'm still over at the Capitol and keep an eye on things there. But
maybe I'll ask you about missing the countdown in just a few minutes.
I was minority leader, and it was the pressure to uphold vetoes for Pawlenty, and now it's the total opposite, where you have a DFL governor and a Republican legislature. So it's just so Minnesota is just such an interesting state in so many ways.
That's a good word, Marty. Interesting when it comes
to
this.
That's Minnesota polite. You know how we are. We're, you know, interesting is a code word for a lot of things.
But listen, I do want, and maybe we'll ask you about that in a little bit, but let's talk about this book, because it's called Sundown at Sunrise, and it is, it reads like a novel, but it's actually based on an actual true crime. But the level of detail that you have in there, you know, you've got conversations, and so it has it reads like a novel, which is right.
It's historical fiction based on a true story, so it's the sweet spot of keeping people's interest. Absolutely.
All right. How did you? I mean, what made you decide? Why don't you tell us a little bit about the crime story, and what made you decide, I really want to do this. I really want to go in depth into this and get into this story and recreate these people's lives.
Yeah, you know, I grew up by the murder site. Clemens is the town that it took place by. It's a farm place 2 miles north of Clemens on the corner. It's still there. It's an abandoned farm place on the corner of Minnesota 68 and Redwood County 1, 2 miles north of Clemens, 6 miles west of Morgan, where I went to high school. And we used to drive by this murder site when I was growing up. And I would ask my, you know, I was maybe 8 or 10 years old, and I would ask my dad, hey, you know, why does anyone live in that farm place? Because it's so nice. It's such a good location. And, you know, at first he'd kind of say something bad happened there and kind of hit the accelerator. as I got older, he filled in the blanks with, you know, there was a guy who was a murderer. He was like 3 years older than grandpa. And he took an axe one night, and he killed his wife with the axe, and he murdered his 4 children, and then he hung himself in the kitchen. And there was a teacher that lived with them, and kind of a scandal with her, and she taught at the Sunrise Schoolhouse, which was across the road. That's where I got the title Sundown at Sunrise. He murdered them at sundown, March 24th, 1917, near the Sunrise Schoolhouse, which was right across the road. So I just, you know, I got into politics. I, you know, graduated from college. I taught high school. I did all these different things, built the cancer center in Marshall, raised the money for that and so forth. And then when I got done with all of that, I always had on my bucket list to write a book. And when I met with the publisher out of the Twin Cities, they said, oh, you know, you're probably going to write about, you know, running for governor or being in the legislature during these interesting times. And I said, no, I want to write about a true crime murder in my home area. And he's like, oh, thank the maker, because nobody buys these political books. he said, this genre is awesome. People love true crime if they like Minnesota history or true crime or kind of a mystery. And I really wanted to be rich and vivid with the details of how people lived in those days.
Well, I think you really clearly have got that, folks. And again, the book is Sundown at Sunrise by Marty Seifert. And the detail, the dances and, you know, the sort of the courting, how people
once a week. And I mean, people today can, and I spoke at Tracy High School to their senior high English class, and they all read the book. And, you know, they can't imagine taking a bath once a week and not having running water, electricity, a crank telephone. I mean, it's just, I really wanted people to feel how they lived back then. Of course, they were transitioning from horses to cars and from horses to tractors. And so, and people can see pictures of characters out of the book. There's a Facebook page for Sundown at Sunrise. There's a website for Sundown at Sunrise, and I give presentations. Now, I'm not having any between now and the end of session because I'm just too busy with my real job. But I'm going to be doing a variety of presentations on the book, and I have big poster boards. I show people the characters and the towns. And it's usually a one-hour presentation, so there's a variety of libraries in the Twin Cities and beyond in Minnesota that will be having me throughout the summer and fall. It's just a ball. I love it. I had over 120 people show up in the Redwood Falls one.
Wow. Okay, that's great. And again, the book Sundown at Sunrise, and there's a Facebook page. But let me ask you, because it's the detail, I think, is really, I mean, you really, it's very rich, and you really do feel, I think you succeed there in getting people to feel what it was like and just the minutiae of, you know, how the clothes and the relationships and
right. How
you...
Yeah, 1909 to 1917 is the time frame, and I really wanted people to feel like they were living there with the family. And, you know, going into town and going to church and the different, you know, and I got a lot of that from my grandparents. I listened very carefully when I was a kid. I love history, particularly Minnesota history. And so, you know, for them, Monday was wash day. Saturday was kind of the cleaning and baking day. Sunday was church day and relaxation day. And so I modeled a lot of what's in that book off of what my dad and what my grandparents had talked about when they were little, and just kind of molded it together.
But did you have any other sources? Because as I said, I mean, the level of detail is really great. I thought you really did a great job with that.
I took a ton of newspapers from that era when I was looking up, like, when the murderer got married. Like, you know, they had their first child 9 months and 2 days after the wedding. So, you know, the listeners can figure the math out on that. But, you know, I looked up a lot of the things that were true. The woman who was murdered, her dad ran for sheriff in Redwood County. And in those days, they ran partisan, so he ran as a Republican. I just stumbled onto that in the Redwood Gazette. And I was able to put a lot of chapters in the book together based on stumbling into things in the newspaper. And so a lot of the stores that you read about in the book are they had advertising in the Redwood Gazette or the Morgan Messenger. And so I pulled those stores and the advertising together so people knew. And of course, the obituaries where the murderer is buried with two of the children, and then the wife that he murdered is buried with the two little children. You know, all of that's true. And you can go out to the Redwood Falls Cemetery and see her buried on one end of the cemetery and him buried on the other. And I get a lot of good questions at these presentations, like, why was the murderer allowed to be buried with two of the children? I don't have a good answer for that. It could have been financial. It could have been that the parents were, both sets of parents were still alive when he did this, because he was only 31 years old.
Wow.
So, you know, when people read Sundown at Sunrise, they kind of get a flavor for a lot of that. So I would say, you know, of course, all of the conversation is fictionalized because no one's alive from 100 years ago. But just the interesting things that have happened since the book got published, the niece of the murderer contacted me.
Wow.
And she didn't know anything. I researched whether he had any descendants, and I couldn't find any. I looked kind of on 20 years on each side of the murders. She was born 23 years after the murders, and I never knew she existed, and she never knew about this, that her dad's brother axe-murdered his wife and kids. They kept it from her all these years. She was never told by anyone.
That's a little bit of a shock there.
Oh, my gosh. She was totally stunned, and so I get this Facebook message like a week after Christmas. She read it around Christmas because a Shirttail relative had said, hey, I know your maiden name was Kleeman, and you might be interested in this really good book. And here she sat down and read it at Christmas time. And at the end, her dad is the teenager who's writing the obituaries with her grandmother. And she was just totally stunned by the whole thing. And so I got this Facebook message. It started out saying, I am the niece of William Kleeman. And I thought, oh my gosh, I mean, she's got to be 120 years old because this happened over 100 years ago. And here it comes that her dad was the youngest sibling, and she's the only child of the youngest sibling, and he was married when he was older in life. And so I feel somewhat guilty. I feel guilty just naturally because I'm Catholic and so forth, but I feel really guilty about just kind of telling her about this when she's 77 years old. She had no idea that this had happened
In her family, so. And obviously they had moved on. Actually looking at the Facebook page, which is wonderful. It's sundown at sunrise, and you've got these fabulous photos. Where did you come across all these photos, too?
Most of the photos came after the book was published. I had people like Frank Schottenbauer, the hired man. There's a picture of him from 1909. We're going to be posting a picture of the sheriff next week. We had pictures sent to us of Maud Kleeman. I didn't know what she looked like until her great-great-niece from California sent me a picture. I knew what Henry Petrie looked like because he ran for sheriff and he had his picture in the paper. But a lot of these other characters are on the Facebook page. So, yeah, sundown and sunrise, it's real easy. And the webpage, too, so people want to order the book online, they can just go to sundownatsunrise.com and order the book there. Or it's on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or independent bookstores can get it for you. But generally, these Facebook pictures that we put out have all come after the book was published. And the publishing standards are that if it's historical fiction, even if it's based on a true story, you're not supposed to put pictures in the book. So I learned something as a first-time author.
Oh, really? And why is that? Because it's a work of historical fiction?
Or just the family doesn't like how you treated the character. So, I have it as kind of a proven fact that William Kleeman did the murders. Although my great uncle, who was the coroner, conducted the inquest process, and they did it very quickly. And a lot of these speeches I've been giving at the high schools and so forth, people are like, someone else could have done this. In fact, the niece found a little letter after she dug her cupboards apart that belonged to her parents. The niece met with me for supper, and she found a little thing that said, "My dad never believed that these murders happened, that the hired man may have been involved or something." And so she said, "I don't know if this was, our family rationalizing this, or if maybe someone else did murder the family and he was set up."
Yeah.
People read it, you may have a little bit of doubt in your mind at the end. Did he really do this? Now, I go based on the law, the inquest, and the newspapers, and I say that he did it. But if you read the book, you might surmise that someone else was involved.
It sounds as if this book is, normally you write a book and sort of that's it, and, people read it and whatever. But it sounds like it's almost sort of having a life of its own after it's written.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. We have so many speaking requests, I can't hardly keep up with it. And the libraries, of course, they can pay my mileage and all that kind of stuff. They have legacy funds and these little programming budgets. And so they have people pestering them. I was down in Jackson, Minnesota, giving a speech not too long ago, and the librarian said there were 30 people on the waiting list.
Wow.
For getting the book. So, that's interesting when you think that many people. So they were going to buy another copy of the book after the book was available. So that's kind of the interesting piece of it is she said, "I need to buy another book and cut this waiting line in half."
Well, so. It would be the perfect book for a class studying, Minnesota history or American history.
It's relevant to social studies and history. It's relevant to English.
Right. Because it really does sort of show how people lived in this part of Minnesota, at that time. Well, let me ask you this, with this obviously a success, and I guess, let me ask you, so I want to make sure people know where to get the book. Sundown at Sunrise, .com, or you can go through Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You say it's pretty much anywhere where books are sold.
Yeah, independent booksellers. I love these small bookstores.
Oh, sure.
And hope people can patronize them. They can order it for you. Sundown at Sunrise.com. It's probably the easiest way because it goes directly from the warehouse in St. Louis Park right to your home. So, it's there like a day and a half later. But sundownatsunrise.com has a lot of info. And they also are going to be putting out my next speaking engagements. I think we're posting all the new speaking engagements here in a week or two. So if people are interested, it's always good to read the book first, of course. But We've had book clubs. I was speaking in Glencoe. They had 3 book clubs. They all came, filled up the room. It's just been really fun. And the Facebook interactions, you know, usually you put stuff on Facebook and it might have 20 or 30 likes or shares. And when we first put the book out there, it had like 300 shares and like 600 likes and like 100 or 200 comments. And I was just blown away that people were so interested in this. But there's so many people in Redwood County and that neighborhood in southwest Minnesota who had no idea this had happened. And so they're really fascinated. I feel bad for the farmer who owns that abandoned farm. The neighbors told me there probably isn't a day or a week that goes by that they don't see vehicles going back and forth down the driveway, you know, because people just have this morbid curiosity, you know.
Right, absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. Obviously, this has gone well. I mean, any other books in Marty Seifert's future?
I would like to do a prequel to this and a sequel to this. And the prequel would be the Tibbetts murders that happened by Delhi, which is just a small town that's north west of Redwood Falls. This murder happened south of Redwood Falls. And that, if you remember right reading the book, the Tibbetts murders happened right when Maud Petrie meets William Kleeman. And so the era is about the same. The county is the same. And so I would like to do a prequel. It'll be the same thing. It'll be historical fiction based on a true story. Although I think at the end of the book, I'm going to have William Kleeman maybe sitting in the back of the church or standing out at the cemetery or something, just to move it in.
Right,
the sunrise,
right.
Sunrise. And then the sequel would probably be relevant to the school teacher. You know, she dies a year and a half after the murders. She's the one who finds all the bodies, or at least finds him hanging in the kitchen, and the neighbor finds the bodies when he arrives. But she does in true life. She dies a year and a half after the murders.
Wow.
She dies in Mankato. She doesn't stay for the funerals. She hightails it out after the inquest. She hightails it out in the steam train out of Morgan on Tuesday. The funeral for William is Wednesday. The funeral for Maud and the kids is Thursday. Good Friday is the next day. And so she gets out of town, basically, and she moves along to try to teach school again south of Mankato. And then she actually dies of influenza. I do not say at the end of the book what she dies of. I just say that she dies to keep people interested in what's going on here. But since your listeners are so awesome, I'll just tell people that she died of influenza. She did not commit suicide, which was what most people think she did.
Wow. Well, listen, you know, it's a fascinating book. And again, it's really rich in the detail and sort of the layering and what it was like and what these people were like and what they wore and how they, you know, what the places were like and all that. So and congratulations on it. Again, it's Sundown at Sunrise, and you can get it anywhere books are sold. And then if you want to see where Marty Seifert might be speaking, go to sundown@sunrise.com, and eventually they'll post up some of your appearances there, right?
Absolutely, yes. It'll be put on the Facebook page and on the website at sundown@sunrise.com. But it's just been an absolute whirlwind. We had no idea it was going to take off like this. We had to do a reprint after the first 2.5 weeks. We thought 3,000 books would last a couple of years, and we were out in a couple of weeks. And
well, you do a really nice job, and as I said, it's very you really do a very vivid portrait of these characters and what it was like, you know, just what the bars were like or what the courting is like. Anyway, very good stuff. So
it's just shocking the things that kids don't know today. Like when I spoke at Tracy High School, now I'm not that old. I just turned 45 last week, but they don't remember seniors in high school what it's like to go to a bar and have smoking there. Can you believe that? You know, yeah. I mean, that's how long we've had the smoking ban.
Right.
Something you and I maybe remember, these kids today are like, oh, there was smoke in these bars. I'm like, of course.
Absolutely. All right. Well, listen, Marty Seifert, thank you so much. And so you're not missing that, well, it sounds like you're involved, but that rush or that grind through May 22nd?
Absolutely. The legislature will be done one way or another, but it could be July instead of May. We're just kind of keeping our fingers crossed to get done on time.
Yeah, it looks a little dicey to me, but
that's a good word for it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I always have the pride when I was minority leader. We never had a shutdown. We didn't have an unnecessary special session, those 3 sessions. So it's always a badge of honor because it has been kind of tough the last 10 years or so with with kind of getting things done on time.
All right. Well, congratulations on the success of the book. And folks, it really is. If you are at all interested in history or sort of crime stories, it's a great read. Thank you so much, Marty. And I'm so glad that we finally got you on, and I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Marty Seifert, folks. And again, the name of the book, Sundown at Sunrise. It's really, I'm not surprised at all that it's doing this well. And actually, the companion Facebook page is really cool with some you know, really cool pictures. And he explained, you know, why he can't have the pictures in the book, but he's got all these pictures on the Facebook page, which is very cool. All right, folks, I'm a little overdue for a break. Let's take a quick break. We got much more ahead. You're listening to News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It is 7:33 in the Twin Cities. Well, earlier today in numerous places around the metro area, there were drug and opioid take-back centers where people were asked to bring in their old prescriptions and dump them off, leave them so they could be disposed of properly. It's part of an effort that has been going on for a number of years, but has been accelerated recently because of the growing problem, the epidemic, really, of opioid abuse and the synthetic opioids. And the situation here in Minnesota seems especially serious with some of the latest figures that have come out. Joining us right now is Carol Falkowski. She is a longtime expert in this field, and it was just a couple of weeks ago when the group that she organizes, her consulting firm, really came out with some new analysis of this trend, and it's a pretty dire situation. And so we're grateful to Carol for joining us tonight to talk about this and to talk about what ways we can perhaps work together to combat it. Carol, thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me.
All right, absolutely, Carol. Let me ask you, what are some of the latest, you know, analyses and statistics and figures that you were able to put together that really show how serious this matter is?
Well, just for a little intro, I've been writing a report on drug abuse trends in the Twin Cities for over 30 years. It's sometimes twice annually most of that time. And it amazes me that having done it over all those years, that every 6 months there's something new to write about concerning drug abuse. It shows what a changing landscape it is. And the most recent report had some very significant findings regarding opiates in the Twin Cities. It found that just in Hennepin County, that overdose deaths related to opioids in Hennepin County went from 97 to 153 in just 1 year.
And that's between 2015
and 2016.
And 2016. 97 to 153. That's deaths in just Hennepin County.
Yeah, and a similar pattern in Ramsey County. And in all the years I've been doing this, we've never had really that sort of magnitude of increase in deaths related to any drug, whether, you know, it was crack cocaine or whether it was methamphetamine. This is really sort of an unprecedented increase. This really sets us off and helps clarify the nature of this problem and the extent of the problem. I mean, this opioid crisis is something that's been in the works for at least a decade now, and it really shows, you know, there's few little bits and pieces and fits and starts of good news, but overall, I mean, it just continues to go pretty much unabated.
And, you know, I think that those figures, that increase is so startling over 2015 and 2016. And I think that there are a lot of people who thought, perhaps, that, you know, the tragic death of Prince in April of 2016 might, I think it did shine, you know, a light about how this really can happen to anyone, no matter how wealthy you are, no matter how successful, no matter what kind of a genius you might have, that it can happen to anyone. And I think there are some people who thought, well, maybe this will lead to sort of a downturn at all. And obviously that didn't happen. I mean, do you have any sort of thoughts or perspective on that?
Well, in terms of what Minnesota has going for it, clearly the overdose death of Prince that was related to counterfeit pain pills that actually contained the very strong fentanyl helped raise public awareness of this problem. So we have that going for us in terms of visibility. We also have in Hennepin County now a new prevention program called Hashtag No Overdose that's having community meetings throughout Hennepin County. We have a statewide bill that provides naloxone, which is like an antidote for people who overdose, so they can get that right on site and have that overdose reversed, much like people who are allergic to bee stings can get, you know, epinephrine or hit with a little EpiPen. And we also have a very active advocacy group that was started by some parents of a young man who died of an opiate overdose. And that really has been a organizing point, the Steve Rumler Hope Foundation. So those are some things that we have going for us. But in terms of how to really reverse this trend, it needs more than the forces we have been able to bring to bear so far in this state. Yeah. One of the biggest things that we need, and you know, when you look at how to respond to a drug epidemic, it really boils down to treatment, prevention, law enforcement. Those are the three traditional prongs of it. But because of the role that the medical profession plays in prescribing prescription opioids, we also have to look with this epidemic at medical practice. If I could talk about treatment for a minute, even though Minnesota has a lot of treatment available relative to other places in the country, and in fact, you know, we have some of the leaders in addiction treatment located in our state, I happen to work at one of them, you know, the Hazelden Foundation, for 10 years. And even though we have treatment that's both quality and accessible, like other parts of the country, treatment needs to do better in responding to opiate addiction. And what I mean by this is that we know that effective medications are available for the treatment of opioid use disorders. But not as many people get those medications as should get those medications, because many treatment providers in Minnesota tend to base their treatment not really on science, but on ideology. So in other words, they don't really believe in using medications.
Well, are you talking about really, are you talking about the Suboxone, if I'm pronouncing
that? Yeah, Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone. Those have been very effective and proven effective. In fact, the World Health Organization says that buprenorphine and methadone are really essential medicines. But it's estimated nationwide that maybe only a third of the patients in the nationwide with opioid dependence actually receive those medications. And this is a persistent problem, not just here, but all across the country. And when I was director of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division at the Department of Human Services, this was an area where I really tried to move the field forward to get them to embrace the medications for this chronic disease with behavioral components, much as we use medication for other chronic diseases with behavioral components, like diabetes and high blood pressure. But it was really a hard nut to crack. And I was reminded a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a woman, and it was in regard to lining up a speaking appearance that I was making. And I was talking about points I was going to be covering about opioids. And I mentioned this point, and she said, "Oh, that sounds like my son." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Well, my son is a 19-year-old heroin addict, and he has been in 12 different treatment programs."
Wow.
And he's still using heroin. He's 19 years old. And when I asked her, I said, "Well, has he ever used, you know, medication-assisted treatment?" And she said, "What's that?"
Wow, okay.
But that's incredible to me, because think of a doctor that you go to for high blood pressure and he doesn't tell you, "Oh, by the way, we have medication for that." Or a doctor, you know, you have diabetes and he doesn't mention insulin. I mean, it would be unheard of. But yet people are not getting the kind of quality treatment for addiction that they could be getting in this state. And I think that's a big hurdle we have to overcome to really turn the tide on this.
Well, I do know that for Suboxone, and what was the other one? I've heard of methadone. What was the other one that you mentioned?
There's buprenorphine is Suboxone.
Okay. But in order to prescribe that, you have got to, for a doctor to be able to prescribe that, apparently you've got to go through special training.
Yeah, it's not very long.
What's that?
It's about 8 hours. It's not very long.
Oh, it isn't. Okay. Because and the prescription, because I was talking with a doctor who, apparently there are only about 100 doctors in Minnesota who've gotten that training.
Exactly.
And it's also apparently it's highly regulated. The doctors can only have so many patients or whatever. I mean, do those kinds of barriers need to be removed?
That needs to be looked at as well. And it's a challenge.
Because, but isn't that the FDA, though? I mean, that's...
Well, the DEA looks into it, and it's all FDA approved, and this has really been proven by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and the World Health Organization. I mean, all that approval has long been in place. It's really a matter of getting more physicians to do it, and it's a challenge because, you know, people who are addicted, are very, can be very challenging patients. So, Matt, all doctors will say, you know, wake up in the morning and say, gee, I think I'll start treating heroin addicts.
Right. You know? But so the training is only 8 hours because, like, in the Prince case, I mean, one of the things that has emerged is that a very famous treatment doctor in California, that they tried to get him to come in overnight and he couldn't, you know, take the red eye. So he put his son on a plane with some of this Suboxone. The son was not a doctor. And he was going to bring it to give it to apparently a Minnesota doctor because that Minnesota doctor didn't have the training. But so there was the Suboxone was actually a factor in that. But you're saying from where you stand, you think that more people, this is a helpful tool in helping people
cope
and it helps with the withdrawal.
It's not a withdrawal medic. Well, it helps with the craving. So Hazelden started incorporating Suboxone in their treatment. They realized a number of years ago that many of their opiate patients were leaving without staff approval, and a sizable number of them not only were leaving, but then many of them were overdosing after they had left. And so they wanted to really take a look at what they could do to improve their medical practice, and they incorporated the use of Suboxone in their treatment regimen. And at the time, I thought, well, this is great. Hazelden is such a leader. Certainly other treatment programs in the state will follow suit, and there will be more people getting the help they need through the use of these medications. But that has not necessarily been the case, and that was really underscored when I, again, talked to this mother recently.
Wow.
Whose son, I mean, imagine, he had 12 different treatment episodes, and not once did the treatment.
At the age of 19.
Yeah, right. And so how many other people are there out there who aren't getting the help they need and just having these repeated treatment failures when, in fact, there's medication that can be brought to bear on it? The National Institute on Drug Abuse has been looking at incorporating medication-assisted treatment into emergency departments. And it found, and there's an article recently published in JAMA about that, that says that emergency departments are a great opportunity to screen patients for opioid use disorder and initiate medication-assisted treatment. And they found that when patients start it in the emergency department, they are more than twice as likely to remain engaged in treatment compared to patients who are referred out to treatment.
Interesting.
So there's something about, you know, the immediacy of treatment. And if they get started on those medications while they're in the emergency room, they're twice as likely to stay engaged in treatment. So this is something that the federal government is really promoting, and how you can get this better incorporated not just into primary care practice but into emergency room settings as well. And the results so far look really promising.
Wow. Okay. Listen, Carol, we do have to take a quick break. Could you stay with us? Because I would like to ask you about fentanyl and carfentanil, which are these synthetic opioids. I think everybody gets, you know, the opioid that you get a prescription for your knee surgery and it lingers around. You take too much of it and you can get hooked. But these other ones are so powerful and so strong. And apparently people are getting them sometimes and they don't even realize that they're getting them. So can you stick around with for just a little
absolutely.
Bit with us?
Happy
okay,
to.
Absolutely. All right. So more with Carol Falkowski about these new synthetic opioids that are many, many more times more powerful. One of them is the one that killed Prince, about how these are coming on the market here. People are getting their hands on these and they are dying because of it. So stay here. You're listening to News Radio 830 W. It is 7:50 in the Twin Cities. Esme Murphy with you until 9 o'clock. Coming up in our next hour, a chat with Professor David Schultz. But right now we are chatting with really one of the nation's leading experts on drug abuse, and we're talking about opioids. And Carol Falkowski, I want to ask you about fentanyl and carfentanil and these synthetic opioids. What are they, and how are people getting their hands on them?
Well, we'll start with fentanyl. And fentanyl has historically been used in medical practice in surgical situations and immediately after surgery. But in recent years, it has shown up on the illegal drug market, and it's not the fentanyl that's made in, you know, laboratories by big pharmaceutical companies, but it's made in clandestine labs typically located in China and then imported into this country. And fentanyl in that form has been found and implicated in the counterfeit pill that was involved in the death of Prince, as well as in the supply of powdered drugs such as heroin or methamphetamine or cocaine. And it's often with the end users without their knowledge, and perhaps even without the knowledge of people who are immediately involved in the retail sale of it. So it could be that people who are going out and just thinking they're buying heroin, as they always had, can encounter a batch that has some fentanyl in it. And because fentanyl is so much stronger than morphine and so much stronger than heroin, just a little bit of it in that supply is enough to result in death. Now, in Hennepin County, I mentioned the Hennepin County deaths. In 2015, 9 of those opiate deaths involved fentanyl, and that jumped to 39 in 2016. So from 9 to 39.
And so you're thinking are people getting these counterfeit pills from China or the black market, and they don't know. They think that they're getting like an oxycodone, and they don't realize that it has fentanyl in it?
Absolutely.
So that's exactly what's
happening. And it's so insidious. It's something that has never really happened before. And it's the wild card that really makes buying either powdered drugs or, you know, counterfeit pills, you know, from a guy who knows a guy who knows a guy, such a dangerous and potentially fatal proposition.
Okay, so the bottom line is, and how big is, I mean, are people, how are they getting these counterfeit pills? Is it, you know, a guy that knows a guy that knows a guy, you know, or your neighbor's neighbor's neighbors or whatever, or are you actually, can you sit there and order it on the computer from China?
Pretty much both of those things.
Wow.
And it's something that has to be, everyone's on a learning curve in the field of law enforcement on how to shut this down. And look at how hard it is to track it down, even in a high-profile death case like we had with Prince. So the people who sell these counterfeit pills or these street drugs often have no specific information about the contents of the products they sell. And so there's no way to know or ascertain just by looking at the appearance of a drug or a pill if it actually has fentanyl in it. Now, the second drug that you mentioned is carfentanil, and that is another synthetic variation of fentanyl. But this is carfentanil is a drug that is used to sedate big mammals like elephants and hippos and rhinoceroses. I mean, it's used in veterinary medicine. There's no human use of this, and several weeks ago, the Hennepin County Medical Examiner had a press conference and said that carfentanil had been involved in 5 deaths in Minnesota.
Wow.
And they were looking at another 5. They had their first one last week that happened in Milwaukee. And it's starting to show up in many other cities. Now, this is so potent that even something equivalent to like 2 grains of salt, imagine you spill some salt on the
table. That's what they were saying, yes.
2 grains can be fatal. So it's, in a sense, it's unbelievable. It's almost like some sort of science fiction movie, but this drug supply being contaminated with these lethal drugs is a situation really we have never faced in this country before.
And they're that much more powerful than the regular opioids or the prescription ones.
Fentanyl is 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin, and carfentanil is, you know, thousands of times more powerful than that. So,
and are these? Let me ask you this: are they expensive on the black market? I mean, are people paying like $1,000 per pill, or is it?
No, I think
$100 a pill.
I think that's one of the things that is to be determined, but they are not prohibitively expensive, is my understanding of it.
Right. And I guess, you know, for all the efforts that, you know, law, like, you know, for instance, Senator Klobuchar has a bill that, you know, to have an opioid registry, which obviously is a good idea that everybody should, you know, register this and, you know, states can share the information. But as are you worried that there's even the danger as we try and monitor the prescription of opioids? And we only have about a minute left, that more people will turn to this black market form that is so desperately deadly?
Well, that is an issue, and we need to use, we have a prescription monitoring program, and states are communicating more and more across state lines to use them. They're absolutely cut down on doctor shopping. But at the same time, we need to get the word out as a public health message that buying street drugs in any kind of powder form or pill form can contain, that, you know, these substances can contain fentanyl, and it is more of a game of Russian roulette than it's ever been before.
So wow.
It's not just buyer beware, it's buyer don't buy.
Right, because it's gotten even more dangerous than it ever has been. Well, Carol Falkowski, great information. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Esme.
Absolutely. Scary stuff, folks. All right, keep it here. You're listening to News Radio 830. David Schultz is next.